and rolling.
Camera.
Rolling.
Old History, World War in the Pacific. This is Father Marcian, 92-27, take 55.
Today is January 31st, 1992. Could you please state your name?
Yes, my name is Father Marcian.
And how old?
A lot of the people here up in the island say Marcian.
How old were you on December 1941? How old were you in December of 1941?
31.
Could you recall the accounts of early December?
Oh, when I came to Guam, I was 30 years old. And I have been here 52 years. So that makes 82 years of age.
On December, in the early part of December, when the Japanese invaded Guam in 1941.
December, they bombed on the 8th, which was Monday here. It was Sunday in Hawaii. And they invaded on Wednesday, the 10th.
Can you recall your past experiences, January of 1942, and kind of bringing it through your time at the prisoner of war camp in Japan?
Well, they invaded, the war started, they were bombing here at the same time as Honolulu, you know, and the Philippines. And that was Monday here, which was the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. It was a Monday. And I had two masses every Sunday and Holy Day, at first at Mariso. I forget if it was 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. And then I went down to Mariso, Umatic, for the second mass. And just before I started this mass, it was a high mass, there were some planes that flew over. And the boys, the servers, they were looking out the window. I said, don't bother, those are planes. They were Japanese planes. So I had a high mass and received six girls into sodality. And after the mass, I was invited over to the commissioner's house. I remember I was pouring milk into my coffee when a young man who had run 7 miles from Agate down to Umatic, jumped on my car, a two-door Dodge sedan. He was honking the horn and yelling out, you know, in Chamorro that the Japanese are bombing Sumai. Sumai. That's where the, that was the station, you know, there. And so then when I left, I went back to Mariso. I watched out for planes and I went back to Mariso. And then the second day, a plane came over and just shot over the houses in Mariso, you know, a machine gun. And then on Wednesday in the morning, I saw two planes over in Arahan. And one was bombing over there. The other plane followed the road right around and came right up to Mariso. In right over the road, and just as he got to my place, he reached an outside trigger to drop a bomb, and they tried to bomb the school or the Corman's house, which is near there. The governor's summer house and Corman's house were like two of a kind. That had been the radio station area in 1925. So this plane dropped a bomb, and the closest it came to either of the buildings was about 60 feet. And then he went up to Umatic, turned around and came back, and dropped another bomb, which landed in the hills. Then he went out to sea and dropped one on the way in, and that landed up in the hills too. And so that was Wednesday. And during that time, well, the Japanese had started the invasion during the night. They invaded up here, you know, and along the shore. And that evening, the corpsman, we had the patrolman. Each village had a, before the war, had a patrolman or a corpsman. If it was a large village, they had one of each. Smaller villages had either the patrolman or the corpsman. And so the corpsman for Mariso was Sprague, and then we had the also the Marine, Anson. The three of us stayed, we went down to Gayos Valley that evening. And the people left the houses. And we went down and stayed in a little shack. And the next morning, we could see Japanese soldiers, you know, going by. So we decided to go out and surrender. So the three of us went out, and there was a little group of Japanese there at the road. We came out and surrendered, you see. And they took us up to the school and to the corpsman's house. The patrolman they kept there for questioning, and the corpsman and I were taken over to the corpsman's house. And we were there, and they said, if you don't go outside, you'll be shot if you go outside. So we stayed there. And that evening, they had all left. And we were getting ready to go to bed. We were pulling mattresses out on the front porch when the local school principal came by with a carabao to tie his carabao out. And he stopped on the way back. He said, what are you men doing here? We said, we were told we would be shot if we went out. He said, no, they've all gone. So we left and went back to my place, and some of the stuff was in the house was like, you know, mixed up. For the first time, I had bought a case of Coca-Cola, and they broke some of the bottles, but there was one bottle of Coke, and I had a little gin in a bottle in a cabinet. And I asked Sprague, I said, do you drink? He said, no, but he said, I will now. So I divided up the Coke and the gin, you know, between the two of us. And then we went down and stayed that evening. We were going to hide out down the south of Mariso at Gayos Valley. We were going to hide out, but the mosquitoes were so bad that I think we all said we'll take the Japanese. And so I was there until later on. And Mr. Francisco Isazaki, an old Japanese person down at U-Matic, was in charge. Pardon me. And he sent word up to me to come down to U-Matic, and he would bring me in and get me a pass. Well, we went up to U-Matic, but nobody was there. And then meanwhile, a steak truck came down full of Japanese soldiers, and we just sat there, and they picked us up and brought us into Aganya. And right over here is a place where Commander Castro used to live. And this was like the part of the field office. There were soldiers there, and there was a tent out in front under the carabao tree. I don't know, the carabao, mango.
We better cut for a moment because the airplane is drowning you out.
Yes.
Oh, no, wait a minute.
Yeah. Okay. This is War in the Pacific. Roll 28.
Father, you were talking about being in... Do it again, yeah. Sound warning, please.
Sound is rolling.
Okay. The camera is rolling.
Rolling.
Okay, this is oral history. It's Farsa Marcion, Father Marcion, 92-28, and it's take 56.
Father, we were talking about they had sent you to the Ganya prison.
Yes.
Who was there at the prison when you went there?
Well, one thing I noticed, that the Japanese soldiers did not want to stay down at the south end of the island overnight. They were afraid of ambush on the road because of the hills. And so the last outpost was at Jonya. And they would come down to Mariso after 8 o'clock in the morning, and they were always gone by 4 o'clock. So at first I was hiding out. I had a little beard, I had shaved, and I was going to act like a native. And then I let them see me because they figured, well, somebody must know he's here. Until January 3rd, two cars came down and they took me into Oganya. And one of the fathers took me out and took me over to Mrs. Sawada, and she gave me a pass, the two passes. So then the priests were free then, see? So I stayed overnight there, and then the next day I walked back. Father Sustuinius, the one that was beheaded, he was stationed at Inarahan. And the two of us started walking back with some other people, walking back the 27 miles to 27 miles to Mariso. And I was down there until a couple of days later, and that's when they picked me up again, and then I was in prison, and that was January 3rd. And the other priests up here had been picked up in the 23rd of December. So I was in prison 1 week, and then on January 10th, they took us to Japan.
Who was in prison with you? Who was in the prison with you?
Well, we fathers were together. The prison was the old cathedral, and the mosquitoes were terrible. We didn't have any food. The last day we had, they gave us a little potato. But the Marines had to march down to the harbor, down to Piti, and the rest of us, including the Spanish bishop, we were taken down in trucks. We were taken down to the harbor, down to Piti rather, and then taken out by lighter out to the Argentina Maru. It was a nice new ship that plied between Japan and Argentina, and they put us on there, and then after a couple of hours that we left. We were down in the baggage racks way down the bottom, and it was 4 days from Guam to Zensuji, Japan. 4 days from tropics right into midwinter.
Did you see the other Americans while you were on the ship? The other Americans, the Marines?
We were all together down there.
All together.
Yeah, Marines. And there wasn't too much food, little rice and dried fish. And on the last day, there was no food at all. They said they had no food at all, even for their own people. And so we got off at Zensuji, Japan, southern Japan. To a little waiting room. We waited there about a half hour, and then they brought some bread, gave each one of us a little square piece of bread. And then we went up to what had been Zensuji prison, where they kept the during the First World War, the Japanese were our allies, and they kept the German prisoners of war there in that prison. And we were there almost 2 weeks. And then they took all the civilians of us, put us on the Koganamaru, that's a little mail steamer, and took us up to Kobe, Japan. We arrived in Kobe, and they divided us up arbitrarily into an older group and a younger group. And our younger group were right downtown Kobe at the what had been the Siemens Institute. And the other group was taken up to Butterfield and Swire. You know, it's a private house belonging to importers and exporters. So we were there from February 23rd till October 10th. They moved our camp out because just across the street from us was what they call go-downs, the large brick warehouses. And they took us out of our place, took us up to what had been Canadian Academy. Canadian Academy, back in the back towards the back of Kobe. And then that day they brought in the survivors of from Asia, British and American prisoners. And we were in
Kobe. Yes, camp.
Want me to continue now?
Yes.
Well, we were in Canadian Academy for 2 winters. The first winter we had no heat, and we were there for 2 winters, and then just before the B-29s started coming over to Japan, they moved us all up into one camp up at Zensuji. Futatabe, which was a couple of miles up back of the hills, you know, up at the top. And we were there, and that's when the B-29s became flying over. The first ones we saw were way, way up, like ghosts. And then later on, they flew in lower. And I think it was June the 2nd that there was a big raid on Kobe.
Do you remember what year? What year this was?
It'd be 44. But first of all, the first real raid on Kobe area was St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 1947, and between 1 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and one B-29 was body crashed right on top of our heads. It was hit by a Japanese flyer who dove down, you know, and crashed his plane against the B-29. And one of the...
Just slow down for a moment because...
Okay. Pick up.
Yeah, let's pick up voiceover for Father Marcion.
Yes.
You're talking about the B-29?
Yes. This Japanese flyer, he claimed he was out of ammunition, but he dived down and hit the B-29, and the B-29 separated, and the tail assembly fell right on the hill behind us, and one of the motors rolled down very close to the house, and the rest of the plane went over us, and we could see it against the glare in the sky. We could see it came down, pancaked on a hogback down below us about a half a mile. And only one person came down by plane, by chute, and the other was still in the compartment, you know, the navigator's compartment. Well, we were there until after the emperor's speech, you know, the surrender.
What was the living conditions like? What was the living conditions like in the prison camp?
Well, no food.
How many people were there?
I think about 160 people, but in Kobe itself, there one day for lunch, we had a saucer with 4 little green cucumbers about the size of fingers. That was lunch. And up here, up there where we were at Futatabi. You get about a half a glass or half a cup of burnt watery rice and about a half a cup of boiled cucumber. That would be a lunch. We did get some of the packages, you know, the, we call them the, oh, not the care. We got some packages from Canada first. They didn't send give you any cigarettes. And then the United States, we got a few of those, and then that was the end of that.
That was in 45?
So, yeah. So we lost a lot of weight. We had people there lost 150 pounds. They were big people, huh? I think I lost about 30. You take a shower and look down at your stomach, you know, and you say, is that me? You know.
When did you return then to Guam? When did you return to Guam?
Well, we were there, and
how did you come about leaving Japan?
Well, that's what it, what's your name there? They arrived, you know, the General MacArthur arrived, and then they started sending rescue teams out, and they found there were a lot of camps that were not on the schedule, not written down. So they came to us and asked each one, you know, what did you weigh before, what do you weigh now, and just to determine if anybody needed immediate medical attention. And then they put us on a special train to Yokohama. We got there and they gave us flapjacks and a shower and quick.
Okay, I'm rolling. It's a game pickup for Father Marcia.
Mm-hmm. They flew us from Yokohama to Okinawa. And we were there about a day and a half. And then they flew us on to Manila, near there. We had to fly over those typhoons that did so much damage to our fleet at Yokohama, Okinawa. We got back to Manila, and then after almost 2 weeks, they put 5,000 of us on a ship, a Coast Guard ship. It was built for 2,000. And in, I think it was 10 days, they took us, they took us from Manila to Seattle. We got to Seattle, and then we flew or took a train back to our individual places, you know, our headquarters.
When did you return to Guam?
Then we returned to Guam in March 18th, 1946.
Can you explain what Guam looked like in 1946 compared to what it looked like when you had...
Oh, it was all torn up. The place that was least changed was Umatic, Mariso, and Inaran. But all the other places were very much changed, you know.
Is there anything that you would like to add to this oral history that you would like to see recorded? I mean, you went through the prisoner of war camps and you experienced a lot of that during the war. If there was something that you could save as a part of history, what would you like to say about all of World War II and how you were involved?
Well, when I got back, I went back to Mariso, and they had that massacre down there, two different days, Fa and Tinta, and a man who worked for me was in that, and the cook we had down here at Agana was in that group. You know, the Japanese were very suspicious. Anybody who could work a radio, anyone who was strong or knowledgeable, they were very much afraid. And so that's why they had that massacre there at Mariso. And then the second day, They had the, like, women and children, they were in there too. That was a terrible thing, you know. Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to say? Is there anything else that you would like to say?
No, after I was back on Guam exactly a year, and then I went to Rota. I was there 2.5 years, and I went to Tinian for 9 years. And on Rota, the people were just as the war left them, 2.5 miles this way, 2.5 miles this way. I got the people all to move back to the main village. I got up to Tinian. The people had been brought from Yap there, and we had a leprosarium. There was a leprosarium down at down near Umatic after the war. But that was in 1948. That was moved up to Tinian. And then we had patients from Saipan, Tinian, Rota, Guam, and then from all the Trust Territory. We had the leprosarium for the entire Trust Territory. There was 7 language groups there. Yap, you know, Palau, Ponape, all these places. And that picture you saw on the down at the other place there, that was a picture I painted for the Leprosarium Chapel in 1951. There was another one that was up here, but it was damaged and I haven't been able to fix it up yet. Guam has been changed so much, but there are many customs which we as priests, you know, have seen. They have a great regard for the dead, and the things have been changed so much, and they were always very hospitable. They have some good customs like that, you know. In fact, before the war, they called them Ngingi. They'd always take the priest's hand and kiss his hand. The word Ngingi means actually to smell, you know. They could do it long distance, you know. Go like this, you know. But the... Well, I would say that the young people should follow the old people, because the old people, they were very, very knowledgeable, you know, before the war. I can't think of anything else, especially right now.
Okay, room 12 for Father Marcian's interview.